Hi guys, and welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show. I'm sat here with Dr. Basil Halak.
Hello everyone, pleasure to meet you.
And he's a doctor at Southampton University, does quite a lot of research. Would you like to tell us about what research you've done?
Yes, so I've been here in Southampton University for the past 15 years now, long time. I am mostly interested in hardware security, so trying to develop approaches to secure electronic systems. This goes from developing basically design techniques to protect against things like side channel attack, to developing protocols that are energy efficient, and most recently, I'm more focused on integrating machine learning into basically hardware countermeasures, and also looking at the security of these machine learning algorithms.
So for our listeners who are not aware of Southampton University, or probably maybe you've only associate Southampton with the sinking of the Titanic, especially for our US listeners, what is Southampton University?
Southampton University is in the city of Southampton, which is the south of England. It's a very beautiful city. It's very close to the New Forest. It's a vibrant city, has a large student community. It was established in 1892. I am part of the Electronic and Computer Science School, which was established by Professor Eric Zeppler in 1947. And Southampton University Electronic School has been in the top three places in the UK to study electronics for the past 10 years, as long as I know. So it's a really nice place to do electronics. This is the lab we're sitting in. It's where our graduate MSc student come to do their project. I'm working as part of the cyber security group. We have this group was established in 2016. And we are also a center of excellence for cybersecurity, which was established by Professor Vladimiro Sassone, who is the head of the group at the moment. We also have in Southampton a cybersecurity academy, which is a hub for engaging with industrial partners. Mm-hmm. So we do training and we do consultancy, and I am the director of this academy. And most recently, we have established the Hampshire and Sussex Cybersecurity Cluster, which basically a networking entity for that covers all cybersecurity companies, big and small, and also we've got some defense companies in Hampshire and Sussex.
Hardware security?
Hardware security really is a set of techniques and methods that aims to protect your hardware devices. And when we talk about hardware devices, I mean anything from smartphone to TV to those little sensors you've got at home, like smart sensors. Mm-hmm. We've got hardware all around us. And in hardware security, we are really interested at securing those devices from I would say mostly hardware level attacks, but also looking at attacks that can happen at other layers. Now, the field of hardware security can be divided into three big themes, if you like. The first, which is related to the security of the hardware itself. Mm-hmm. So this is the security of the underlying blocks that actually makes up the hardware. So if we have the example of a house, that would be the security of the bricks used to actually build that house. And that translates into the security of the circuitry, the CMOS circuitry, the transistors, the circuit that actually built that hardware.
The silicon.
And then we've got also the security of the architecture. Mm-hmm. So that's anything from the trusted computing base to secure element to the ARM trust zone. All of these architecture that are built in the hardware, and they aim to secure these devices, not just against some of the hardware threat, but also some of the threat that comes from the upper layers. so software. Mm-hmm. And then we've got the security of the hardware, from which is the slightly different themes from the previous two, against physical attacks. So somebody trying to physically probe into the device, yeah. And sometimes we call this anti-tamper design approaches.
Yeah.
So hardware security really cover all of these topics.
These three layers.
Three layers.
Down at the bottom. Bottoms,
yeah.
And an attacker is always trying to get an end run around the stack.
Yes.
They can come in from the top through the software to attack the hardware, yeah. But also from the physics point of view, using
the transistor level, actually. Yeah. And when we talk about the kind of the security of this, I would say the RTL or the circuitry, if we go back 20 years ago, this was not really a big issue. Mm-hmm. Because mostly, I would say not 20, I think 20 is a short period, maybe 30 years ago. But when we had the system were much simpler. Mm-hmm. So you would be able to, as an entity, to actually build your design and then fabricate it and test it. You don't need anybody else. Mm-hmm. But then as the complexity of our system increased, the IC production or the integrated circuit production moved to an had become internationalized.
It's moved beyond the capabilities of anything but a very large group of people.
Of people. So yeah. Before your phone ends up in your pocket, it will have traveled almost around the globe. So now the supply chain of electronic devices is an international business. And because it's an international business, we managed to get to a point where we can have build these really sophisticated systems and get them at a relatively cheap price.
Yeah.
Now, that advantage came at a cost, which is now we've got many, many possible players, and some of these players can be untrusted, so they can manipulate those circuitry or some of them and create effectively backdoors into these systems.
Okay, so what's, I think a connection is going to be made here for many of our listeners is that we have the same problem in software,
yeah.
It exists in hardware.
Yes.
You have supply chains, you have enormous complexity, unmanageable complexity, yeah. And no idea maybe where a defective component might be coming into your design.
Yeah.
Wow, okay, so it's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge. And I say it's a challenge for hardware, but I think it's more manageable than the challenge at the software layer because the nature of the software, it's probably easier to attack the software and create malware than actually to attack and create malicious hardware component.
It's so much more effort to attack the hardware because the software is ephemeral and changes quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
But the payoff for an attacker to get
into enormous,
the hardware
yeah.
is enormous because we see these what are called class breaks or concept level vulnerabilities in which everything breaks at once. So if we find a backdoor into an ARM processor, every single phone in the world becomes compromised
simultaneously. Yes.
Yeah.
Like what happened with the Spectre and Meltdown, they found that was a vulnerability at the what we call the microarchitecture level that created a backdoor at this level to potentially more serious software attacks. But that compromised all the devices that uses those type of processes.
Wow, and the enormous cost of that. I mean, we joke about, having the light bulb police to go round and tell somebody that their internet-enabled light bulb has been owned and is now, running a command and control server. But, when this happens, it's real physical stuff that's out there.
Yes.
The cost of cleaning it up is
massive. Losing your phone can be quite stressful, but luckily, because of the architectures we have at the hardware level that can protect us from data theft, for example, we are in much better position now to actually handle this type of threat. For example, each phone will have a biometric kind of authentication scheme. So this is your facial recognition. So even the attacker managed to actually steal your phone, they would not be able to have access to it. And the hardware that actually of the phone itself will delete or disable the phone if you actually have more than 10 attempts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the phone itself will be completely useless. And in fact, current phones have also hardware support for remote locking of the phone. So if you actually lock it remotely, then it will permanently be locked, so that the attacker will not be able to do anything with it. Now, we're talking here about normal attacker. If the attacker has more funding.
I've got an enormous laboratory underground with x-rays, electron microscopes, and all the time in the world. Yeah. What can I do with the phone, and what can you do to stop me?
Well, potentially, okay, and again, we're talking here about an attacker that has a lot of resources. Some of the information that's deleted from the memory can be retrieved. And that's because of the nature of how this information is stored in the memory. They leave traces.
Yeah, and these traces, we'll just let's get into the physics for a moment.
Yeah.
That is this CMOS memory on which we're storing?
So if we take, that's not necessarily, but this is for SRAM, for example, but this is CMOS memory, we're talking about CMOS.
In SRAM, these are flip-flops, and the state in which that they will persist.
Yes.
Can stay there a long time after the power is removed because of residual electrons on the capacitors. Is that the?
Yeah, this is one mechanism, but I think if you store the data in that part for sufficiently long time,
it kind of biases the
yes,
gate.
Yes, it's a bias. It's when you start off the SRAM, will still have some of the original.
And it will tend to come up in that state.
Yes. And if you actually have this laboratory and have liquid nitrogen, for example, then you can freeze the memory. You can throw this liquid on the memory and it can freeze its status. Effectively, it's more complicated than that, but effectively you can basically have this information.
But these are probably not the guys who just turned up on a scooter and nicked your phone outside the tube station. Those are not the same guys.
Yeah.
Okay,
And I think also some of the features that the current modern phones have is the you can trace it, so you can identify its location.
Yeah, okay.
And so those trackers are available now. Cars, motorcycle, any. So this technology now it's expensive, but it's available in most kind of sophisticated electronics that allow you to actually potentially retrieve your mobile or your...
Yeah, and we know also that law enforcement are always buying new software and exploits and tools to just go onto the bus electrically and be able to do things with those phones, exploiting potential backdoors that are in there,
So usually, if you are a developer of electronic systems, ideally you will have done some threat analysis.
Yeah.
And you will have in place the countermeasures against this type of threat. Of course, for commercial devices, they might still be vulnerable to, rich attackers or state-funded attackers, but they will be protected against all the attacks that can be carried out by just a normal gang members or just a thief.
Yeah.
But if we have more sophisticated systems, so system that goes into defense or into more critical infrastructure, then they will have the necessary protections which will make it harder, not impossible, for an adversary to attack.
So we can up the hardware defense with various techniques.
Yes.
We'll talk about those soon. Fantastic.
Just going back to the when we talked about hardware versus software, and I think this might be applicable to both, but one of the challenges when it comes to protecting the hardware is that some of these architecture are protected by intellectual property rights. So when we talked about the Meltdown, Spectre Meltdown, this was a vulnerability in some of the Intel processors.
Yeah.
And it wasn't discovered by Intel itself. It was discovered by a security researcher who somehow very cleverly managed to find this vulnerability without having access to the actual IP. Now, and I think the IP issue here, that means that if we compare that with cryptography, as a science, it's 4,000 years old. But the reason now we've got very strong crypto algorithms is because these crypto algorithms actually are open, so everybody managed to have a go at actually trying to crack them.
Yep.
And every time a crypto algorithm is cracked, then people will develop a new algorithm. So this open design framework, mm-hmm. or open source design framework, allowed this system to actually develop to a point where even now the attackers, if they have access to the full algorithm, so they know how this message is encrypted, they even can have the access to the ciphertext, they can't still break the encryption unless they have the key, of course.
Okay. So we what do we call this? We call it Kirchhoff-Shannon principle.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So
is that the attacker can know everything about the algorithm, and this is something that we get through having an open source, open model.
Exactly.
It's very, very important that everybody knows how those algorithms work and that they're public property.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have the same principle is not currently applied to either hardware or software for that mm-hmm. matter.
Yeah.
So we've got these systems. Some of the software you can find open source and you can basically try to find vulnerabilities, but hardware is much harder. Mm-hmm. Because the whole basically business model of some of these companies is that they develop a processor, for example, or a memory block that has certain advantage. So they can't really release their IP. So you're having to trust, effectively, IP designers. You can only basically assume they are trustworthy.
Now, we're getting to some really important words here. Very important words.
Yeah.
They have to trust. And assume.
Yes.
And these are big problem words, aren't they, in any threat analysis in cybersecurity.
Yes.
When we are put in the position of being compelled to trust. And of course, nobody can ever compel one to trust. So what we end up with is opaque, proprietary systems, which may or may not be defective, we don't know. And we can never really reach that golden rule of trust but verify.
Yeah,
because we're prevented from verifying, aren't we?
Yes, we're prevented from verifying. But I think in the nature of things, usually you have to basically, you have limited time to actually produce a product.
Mm.
So you will start with the low-hanging fruit and you will start with the most immediate, basically, potential threat that could realistically happen.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you've got a lot of time and resources, you wouldn't try and actually question this assumption about whether a company like big Intel or ARM or some of these developer of hardware, you wouldn't question their kind of trustworthiness because your task as a product developer. Yeah.
So you don't have many choices. Until we change the semiconductor market.
Yes, exactly.
RISC-V becomes more important thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are other threat models, aren't there? I mean, let's say that we do trust Mr. Intel, the thing that he ships from his factory with his management engine or whatever is
exactly,
in there.
Exactly, yeah.
It is benign. But on the way, it has to go through warehouses, it has to go through other manufacturing process with the motherboard. In a world where somebody can make a surface mount resistor that contains a microprocessor, which only wakes up when it receives a certain serial bit stream, you know, this is a terrifying world of hardware provenance and supply chain.
You're completely right, and I think there is, you must have heard about the Bloomberg story in 2018 where more than the motherboard that is used more than 30 US big company and institutions, including the Department of Defense, was found to have been hacked with what we call a PCB Trojan.
Mm-hmm.
So the motherboard, which is quite complicated in architecture, had a really tiny chip that was shouldn't be there, and it was there, and it created a backdoor into this servers, and which can be exploited by adversaries.
Yeah.
Now, this is a typical example of a hardware tampering attack. now, and they used to, the term that's been kind of called, it's called PCB Trojan.
Yeah.
As opposed to normal Trojan. So 5 years prior to this, because I've done some analysis on this, 90% of the research papers, published research papers, were looking at Trojans that inserted in the IC itself, inside the chip, inside the die.
So the package is indistinguishable from the real product.
Yeah.
You put, you build it into your system, and then it has extra functionality.
Yes. Yeah. And the PCB Trojan, only 10% or even less were looking at a Trojan that can be inserted at the kind of packaging level.
Board
level. Now, that has changed since then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, we talked about Trojan could be inserted at any point. I mean, you mentioned supply chain. They could be inserted at the even at the IP stage.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it's a threat, it's there, but you choose to ignore it. But they could also be inserted, as you mentioned, at the SoC integration stage, so when they integrate different components together, or at the even the manufacturing stage, when you actually fabricate it, because the manufacturer has access to all the design files. Okay. So in principle, they could actually make those changes. Or testing, it's harder, but it's still, very difficult to actually make any change at the testing stage, because at the game you have to manipulate the chip itself. But then this threat, because there are many stages, could appear anywhere. And then as a kind of engineer who's trying to analyze those, you have to take this into consideration. And that's not easy.
No. Oh, it's a huge, enormous problem. Like,
so Apple, for example, or the iPhone that will have more than 20 major chip, and each of those chip have their own supply chain, in addition to other 100 smaller components that make up the full
any
iPhone.
Any one of those components could be defective.
Any of them could be defective. And not necessarily, because we talked about hardware Trojan, which is manipulation of the underlying circuit in order to do malicious activity, but also counterfeiting is another major threat. It's actually more widely basically practiced. So counterfeiting is, a counterfeit IC is a fake IC. So this could be a chip that is defective and sold as a working chip. Could be a chip that's been discarded because it's old, and then depackaged,
and then repackaged
and sold as a new.
Wow.
This is called recycled IC. And this just makes up the majority of the kind of counterfeited chip.
And those would be things like a memory that says it's got 4 gigabytes, but it's actually got 1 gigabyte.
Yes, so
or a processor that won't clock up to the correct speed.
Yeah. So all these counterfeit devices, they get into the supply chain, and they might end up in your product. And without having the right provenance, then it's really hard to prevent these kind of attacks.
What kind of things can we do to look at that? So I'll give an example I know of is scanning of boards. And I think maybe 10 years ago, there was a cryptography researcher called Jacob Applebaum who was really big on X-raying. People can't X-ray their board, so you need kind of much more low-tech things. I mean, a good photograph, a 4K photograph of a board using image processing techniques can actually get you a long way, can't it? If you were able to photograph the board accurately at its point of manufacture and hash that photograph somehow, and then you could take another one later and get a feel for whether or not it's been tampered with.
That will definitely actually help.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the type of threat. So that will help if the sort of modification or the attack you're looking to protect against is just simply changing one item on the board,
mm-hmm.
so that it leaves a mark or it gives a slightly different picture.
Mm-hmm.
But if the attack is basically selling chips that are already nicely packaged,
mm.
and they were actually embedded in the original board, but still they are counterfeit.
And now their trick can be changed. They can be a fuse blown or something
and
changes the functionality.
But signal processing and imaging techniques was actually used extensively with trying to protect a specific type of IC counterfeit, which is related to recycled ICs.
Mm-hmm.
Because when these ICs are depackaged and repackaged again, this all leaves certain marks.
Okay.
So what people did, people like Mark Tehranipour from the state, they developed tools to which been trained by AI models,
mm-hmm.
to recognize the type of defect this kind of process leaves.
Yeah.
And then this tool can be then used to kind of scan the board and identify which chip might have been counterfeited.
Okay, great. So we got some defenses against
that. We've got some defenses. We actually here at Southampton, we developed, because some of my colleagues work on blockchain,
mm-hmm.
and we combine two technologies. One is the blockchain technology and the other is physically unclonable functions. Now, physically unclonable functions are really small circuit. I'm talking about silicon-based physical mm-hmm. functions, so CMOS-based. They are small circuit that generate a binary ID, which is unique to its chip. Even if you implement the same circuit on different chip, they will generate different IDs. The principle, they rely on the process variation. Effectively,
We can't. You can never make one exactly the same.
Exactly.
And we use that uniqueness to then kind of be a fingerprint for that chip.
For a chip. So the system we built.
Presumably, I can't spoof that at some level, you know, if I can inject what the system expects to see.
It's a good point, because even that can be spoofed, and this is different. But this is much harder to spoof compared to just basically storing data in the memory, for example. Mm-hmm. But combining this with a blockchain, we created a tracking systems, which we track it, we created an emulation. So if, as the chip passes through the different stages of a supply chain,
mm-hmm.
they can be checked. So they can be read and then make sure that this is still the same chip that haven't actually been.
Okay.
And this will give you also lifetime tracking of the chip. So if you want to continue to use it, so the original developer of that chip effectively can still have control over it if they want, because they can still kind of talk to it because it has a unique ID.
That actually sounds very scary and potentially dystopian in that the component is forever tied to the source. It's, and its operation is always conditional on you paying maybe like some license fee, or you know, you're only ever renting your technology with things like that, aren't you?
And it's already happening with, the trust, referred to trusted computer or treacherous computing.
Mm-hmm.
Where
trusted or treacherous?
Treacherous, depending where you stand. And effectively, this kind of hardware security architecture will, the goal of it or its advantage to actually stop you or stop the system from running software which is unauthorized.
By who, though?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that means if you are a developer of a particular operating system, you can effectively stop other operating systems from running on the
same. Let's say you were a very big software manufacturer.
Exactly.
And you wanted to maintain dominance in your operating system.
You can.
You could lock out the other operating systems at the hardware level.
Exactly.
That's not something that we want to see, because that's bad for markets.
But it's, we've seen example like this before.
It's already happening.
And if you are in gaming, for example, the digital right management also, it's also a sword with two ends. In one point, it protects the intellectual property of the software and the game. On the other side, the game developers, they can have control over who run these games and where.
Yeah.
Okay. So if there is a restriction or the location of the device, you might not be able to run it, although you've actually paid for it.
And you ostensibly own it. Yeah.
Exactly.
It always comes back to this question that we say that it's secure. There's no such thing as bare cybersecurity.
No.
There is only security for somebody or thing, from somebody or thing, and towards some purpose or aim.
Up this season actually on the podcast is that the InfoSec crowd and maybe some more of the CISOs have said that 90% of the attacks that they're witnessing in the last few years are at that human layer. And so what we're seeing is a push from that InfoSec crowd to say, well, actually, let's take some of that hardware budget and put it towards fixing that issue. Is that going to solve things, or is it going to make it worse?
They address two different type of threat.
Right.
Now, when we do risk assessment, okay, you need to look at impact versus probability of an attack. Okay? So I would agree with those crowd that maybe most of the threat, the probability of this kind of attack at the human level or because of the human factor are much higher than an attack at the hardware level. But an attack at the hardware level can have much more significant impact. And we all remember the case with the pager last year, exploding pagers, and this was a classic example of hardware tampering. So we need our agencies and our university to be able to protect us from an adversary who has this sort of funding in order to tamper with our mobile phones and get them to explode. As simple as that. So you can't, even though it's highly unlikely, it doesn't mean you can ignore it.
That's the issue that you've got, isn't it? Is that if you've got a nation state and they've got an endless budget, they can use that endless budget to go after that hardware, because it is an easier way, essentially, or a quicker way that once you've done it, you can be into a much larger process. Whereas if you're calling people and you're pretending to be the IT department, your return on investment is a lot smaller. Yeah. It will take you a lot longer to do that activity and cost a lot of money, actually, to get successful. And then you may only be in one system at a time. But like you said, hardware, straight in.
Yeah, and this is, you can't bury your head in the sand and say it's not going to happen, because it did happen in the past, it's likely to happen, and unless you actually design and make your devices in your country, basically, you can't be sure that they are trustworthy. So, that's my take on it anyway.
That was going to bring me up to another point, actually, is that what I spent some time looking into is how trustworthy are the devices that the majority of the British public will bring into their homes. So in this instance, I looked at USB sticks bought on the internet, essentially. Yeah, your face says it all. and I found some really strange things. I found they're repackaged, they look brand new. They say they've come from a factory, but they've actually got 500 previous files on them, including videos, all sorts of stuff that led to attacks. What would be your advice on where to source your hardware at home, even in your own lounge? Because it could be dangerous, right?
I think it could be dangerous. And I would say always use a trusted vendor. I mean, don't be deceived by the cheap price, because there's no such thing as free lunch.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm always suspicious when something is free.
Or it's a pound for
it's a pound, that you're gonna pay for this somehow, and it could be simply with your data, and what happened.
What we find as well is that when you're buying things through maybe being an Amazon store, that a lot of people think, well, they had a shop and they had a factory. But actually, no one does that deep research into that factory or that shop or where that factory comes from. Because if you start looking into some of these shops and some of these factories, you find out they're actually another factory, or they're actually lying about where they've come, or their business is not actually a legitimate business that they're running from. All of those things need to be, I guess, in the mindset of the public, just to take that extra step to look at where your products are coming from.
I think that's correct. And I think there should be some messaging around basically which suppliers to trust and which countries to trust and which countries do not trust. Ultimately, if you are bringing a smart device into your home, mm-hmm. you are compromising on your data. I mean, I had the same dilemma before I bought Alexa.
Of course.
Ooh. I mean, I wanted to use it because I like to use the new technology, but it's listening to me all the time.
Yeah.
But then I decided, well, I don't really care. I know they're listening. I don't care because I don't think it's going to do much with it. I mean, this is a decision you need to make at the personal level. Mm-hmm. But also, I think as kind of academics and also as part of the government should be actively given advice on if they have found that certain devices are buggy, and the public should listen.
It often feels like the public are sort of the first line of attack force before the businesses. So, you know, almost like, well, we'll just throw Nan under the bus, and then when it goes wrong for her, we'll let all the businesses know that that's not safe. But I feel that where we speak about this quite a lot, where those lines are being blurred between our homes and our workplaces and our devices go between the two, actually, we do need to start educating people at home on what they're doing, because it can impact their workplace.
Absolutely. And I think last year, was it last year or the year before, they banned TikTok from so my son has a TikTok and watch it, or my daughter as well. And the TikTok is now based in China.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, as with any social media, basically program, whether Facebook or you name it, when you basically log into TikTok, you give it permission mm-hmm. to use your camera, your microphone. And TikTok has very effective algorithms. They measure the speed at which you scroll. They measure, they listen to what you actually say, your reaction. They even evidence that they actually record your face and actually monitor your eye movement. So they are effective algorithm that capable of effectively profiling you. The adversaries, they are not really interested in each individual person.
Right.
Because they might be interested in a whole population, but they are not really interested in you. Mm-hmm. But if there is a specific high or state-funded attacker who is interested in individual person, they can get to them very easily these days.
Which is terrifying. And there's something that we brought up before, actually, with apps just like that, is that you may think it's safe for your children to go on those apps, but you might talk and do your work around them. You might work in a security field and talk around your children just while their phone's in the room and do your work. But actually, that could then be leaked to a state actor that you're trying to essentially protect yourself from through your child's phone, just it being in the room. People don't seem to, even in some really high positions, don't make the connection between all those devices in their home.
Exactly. I think that because we don't read those terms and conditions. Nobody reads the terms and conditions.
I read those.
I read this, yeah. But no one else reads
those. That's true.
And when you just say that you agree that they would, that means you agreed. They have got full access and you have nothing to actually object against it.
That was amazing, Basil. Thank you so much for being on the show. We look forward to maybe catching up with you again in a few years and see what new research you've got out for us to talk about.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be with you and with your listener. Thank you.